My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of introducing Colm McCann. Colm, welcome back to KBOO, and welcome back to Portland.
Thank you so much. So nice to be back.
Yeah, I talked to you about Zoli, but let me run a little paragraph about you. Colm McCann was born in Dublin in 1965 and began his career as a journalist in the Irish press. In the early 1980s, you took a bicycle trip across North America and then worked as a wilderness guide in a program for juvenile delinquents in Texas. I didn't know they had juvenile delinquents in Texas. I thought that was the state legislature.
I think I made them more delinquent than they already were.
Excellent. Okay, that's good. After a year and a half in Japan, you and your wife moved to New York, where you currently live with your three kids. You teach at Hunter College. I know where that is, in the creative writing program. You're the author of two collections of short stories and five novels, including Zoli, for which you were here last time.
Sorry.
Nice book. All of which are international bestsellers. The newest novel is Let the Great World Spin. You've been published in 30 languages and also in The New Yorker and The Atlantic Monthly, GQ, Paris Review, Bomb. What's Bomb?
Bomb is a great magazine that actually used to be, Andy Warhol used to be involved in it way back in the 70s. It's real sort of cool Brooklyn-based magazine.
Brooklyn, everything cool comes out of Brooklyn
nowadays.
Let's see, you've also, you still write for The Irish Times, Die Zeit, La Repubblica, Parry Match, The New York Times, The Guardian, and The Independent. What do you do for in your spare time?
I get my brother to update my website and put all sorts of stuff on it.
Oh, that's good. Okay, so the title of your latest book is Let the Great World Spin. Your name is spelled C-O-L-U-M, first name. McCann, M-C-C-A-N-N, and Random House is the publisher. You know, I was looking over the book this morning to get the characters, and I couldn't come up with Corey's brother's name. Did you not mention it in the book?
It's buried. It's buried way, way deep. His name is Kieran.
Kieran, that's right. Yeah. Spell the Gaelic way. C-I-A-R-A. I can't believe I didn't remember that.
Yeah.
All right. This is a book about New York in 1974 with a little postscript later on that takes place later. But I left New York, native New Yorker. I left there for the last time in December 72. I've been back to visit.
Right.
But when I left it, it was like watching an old friend die of a wasting disease. It was extremely sad. And it got worse later on.
Sure.
Because there was smack and coke on the streets then. And then, of course, the AIDS thing hit in the 70s later on. And New York was really in bad shape. Why did you, what about that time period in New York attracted you?
Well, specifically, it was because Philippe Petit had done the tightrope walk across the World Trade Centers on August the 7th, 1974. And I saw it as the sort of perfect metaphor or allegory for a 9/11 novel. So instead of a moment of destruction with the towers coming down, you have this moment of grace or creation with a character who walks back and forth across the towers eight times. And while the book is not about that, it's all set on the day that Philippe Petit did that. And also, I mean, there, you know the way Tolstoy talks about that you know, happy families are all alike, you know, and maybe happy cities are all alike. So it was interesting to go back to a time when it was really edgy. And as you know, it's like the Bronx was burning, you know, the city was going bankrupt. You couldn't walk through Central Park without getting mugged. There was, you know, heroin needles all over Bryant Park. There was Times Square was a pit. A pit, a disaster.
Yes, the good things were the live sex shows. It got it went downhill from there.
Do you miss the city,
New York?
Yeah,
at sometimes every day, sometimes not at all. You know, I've lived two places since then, and the thing about New York is it's where I'm from,
right.
And I'm always going to be from New York. And when I was growing up, it was the greatest city in the world, right. Which is why watching what you describe happen was so painful.
Mm. And see, the thing about it is, you know, Joseph Brodsky, the poet, he says, you know, you can't go back to the country that doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
And I feel that way about going back to Ireland. I mean, I can't go back to Ireland, but you must feel the same way about, say, going back to New York. It's not the same place, and the same friends aren't there, the same places aren't there. But I think it's a better, cleaner place to live. And a lot of people get nostalgic about, oh, it used to be, you know, so raw, so edgy. But I think I prefer to be able to walk into Central Park and, you know,
you know what,
around.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's absolutely true. The last time I was in New York, which is about 3 years ago now, to visit friends, I walked all the way from the Metropolitan Museum of Art down to the Village. which is a big long walk, and it was wonderful. Walk.
Yeah,
it was a wonderful walk, and it occurred to me how much nicer the city was.
Yeah, well, it's a big poem. I think of New York as sort of like a Walt Whitman poem with like 8 million stories crammed into the small or relatively big city. I mean, there's a couple of million on the island of Manhattan, but then if you include Brooklyn, the Bronx, Staten Island, etc., you have 8-9 million people. And I love that sort of collision of stories and cultures and languages and food. And I actually feel very much at home there. I moved there 15 years ago, and it's my place now. I really like it.
We're not talking about your book, though, are we? Hang on a second. I want to. When I read this book, the very first chapter describes Philippe Petit, although he's not mentioned by name, setting up the walk, and then it goes into it's a lot of first person narrative in this book, about an Irish guy, Kieran, who has come to New York to visit his brother Corey. But he talks about growing up near the Martello Tower, and all I can think of is James Joyce, you know, and stately plump Buck Mulligan, you know, shaving at the Martello Tower.
That's right. And descending the stairhead, bearing a bowl of lather.
you know exactly whereof I speak. So
I know exactly. See, the funny thing is, I mean, you know, I don't want to push it too much, but there are obvious Joycean echoes with this book, and I don't want to put myself in the position where I sort of knock myself up for a tremendous fall, because I know what this book is, and I know what Ulysses is. But my book takes place, mostly in one day, in 12 chapters. It has a sort of alternative Molly soliloquy with a 38-year-old hooker who lives in the Bronx,
and it has the Ulysses in Nighttown chapter as well.
Well, that's it. Yeah, there's lots of echoes. And so for it to go down to Sandy Mount and Dublin and the Martello Towers, there was some amount of consciousness that was going on there, and also just felt like the right thing to do. Because after you have this guy walking on the tightrope in New York, I wanted to displace people. I wanted to make them fall and have them like land in Dublin and say, what the hell is going on here? And so how do stories build themselves, and how does this sort of great world that we live in, how does it spin?
Do all writers feel like they need to escape the ghosts of Joyce and Yeats, or is that just my imagination?
Let me tell you, I got sick March and April, and I've been sick since I was a kid. It wasn't a big deal. I got a thing called osteomyelitis.
Really?
And so I was in hospital in New York for 2 weeks. So I brought Ulysses with me, and I had read it before, but I'd never read it cover to cover all in one sitting. And the beautiful thing was that I read it and I was so engaged, and I found it so funny and everything. But out of the pages stepped my great-grandfather and my grandfather. My grandfather being an old drunk who was from Dublin. And they literally came out. I was on some morphine and I was on some Percocet, but this was, in
good
this way that literature...
Good buzz for James
that's
Joyce.
Right. But see, he, what literature does, it makes us become alive in bodies and times that are not our own. And the beautiful thing about reading Joyce at that particular time was that he introduced me to this whole world. And so I don't feel the ghost of Joyce in any way, more the ghost of my dead great-grandfather and my dead grandfather, and I get introduced to them in the most extraordinary way. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can be obsessed by those greats who've gone before you, like Beckett, Shaw, Yeats, Joyce. If you do, you just get tangled and tongue-tied, and there's always stories to tell. Mm-hmm. That's the thing.
Yeah, and I think the thing that first frees a writer from those influences or those dead hands of the past is that you can decide whether you want to be a first-rate yourself or a third-rate Joyce.
Well, there you go. And if you try to imitate too much, if you become sort of diseased with self-consciousness so that you have to have the Joycean voice and you have to imitate then it's just going to fall away. You develop your own. The thing is, we get our voice, or we get our voices from the voices of others. So we read Joyce, and Joyce instructs us how to carry on, and that's fine. I mean, I would be completely paralyzed if I thought too much about Joyce, but I love the work.
Mm-hmm. Let's get back to the book. When the man walks on the tightrope, It affects a lot of people. I mean, sometimes in a very superficial way, or just taking the time to look up and wondering whether the guy's going to fall 102 stories to his death, or what, 110 stories?
Yeah, 110 stories.
Yeah, 102 is the Empire State Building. But people who are watching it and people who are not watching it are affected in some way by that event. And this is what your book is about. Each is a first-person narrative of people whose lives touch in some way or are touched in some way by that event. How did you – why did you decide to structure the novel this way? Is there a reason?
Well, again, I mean, so much of it goes back to 9/11. And you know, I woke up in New York on September 11, 2001. You know, I'm not interested in the big sort of, all the – what I've explained before was a sort of a grief machine that grew up around 9/11. But listen, there was a lot of, like, terrible things that had happened. My father-in-law was in the first building to be hit, the second building to come down. He had escaped it and so on. But to cut a long story short, there was a level ground of meaning when the towers came down, at least for a short while. Like, everything had meaning. You run your fingers along a windowsill and the ash came up on your finger. You didn't know whether that ash was just pure dirt from the city or whether it was somebody's resume that had burnt down in the World Trade Center, or even a piece of human remains,
yes.
You know? So, and you go into a supermarket, there was no eyewash on the shelves. And that's a metaphor. You know, you watch a lone dog trot across Brooklyn Bridge and you think, where's the owner? You know, so every single thing in the city was charged with meaning at that particular time. And that's an interesting and distressing place for an artist to be. Because if everything has meaning, then how can you make a piece of art that has further meaning about that? And so the question to me was, like, early on, how do you write about 9/11 and get at a moment of grace without boo-hooing about it, and how do we recover from it? And so I thought, okay, I'll go back to that moment in the city when it was beautiful, when somebody did something gorgeous, and then try to talk about the ordinary lives underneath all of that and how it got affected, as you say, got knocked on. Like somebody, there's a woman on a boat coming in from Staten Island, and she looks up and she sees a man in the air. It looks like a little fly in the air, flyman. And she thinks of her son who died in Vietnam, as coming back as some sort of angel. There's another woman who gets annoyed that Philippe Petit takes all the oxygen from the air because everybody wants to talk about him and not about her. There are others who find moments of grace, Christian meaning in the idea of this person way up in the air. Others just think he's an idiot. You know, it's like, so it's all these different complex relationships to this one act of art.
I would like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Colm McCann. The title of his book is Let the Great World Spin, and it's published by Random House. Corey, the brother of Kieran, has come to the United States and has become... He hasn't taken orders. He's not ordained as a priest or a brother,
priest, right.
But he has done a Christ-like thing in the sense that he's done service to the poor.
Right.
And in this case, it's a bunch of hookers who hang out under the Major Deegan Expressway in the Bronx and ply their trade there.
Right.
And he does small things for them. He gives them a place to use the bathroom.
Right.
Gives them a place to sit down, have a cup of coffee, and relax their feet because they walk around in these 4-inch stiletto heels.
Okay.
And he becomes a saint in a way. And I think, like all saints, he's a little crazy, yes?
Yes. Like all saints, he's a little crazy. And like all saints, he's a little doomed. And like all saints, we kill him in certain ways.
His brother comes just to see how he's doing.
Right.
Their father abandoned them when they were young and then came back and tried to reestablish himself after their mother died, and they both rejected him, especially Corey,
right.
Who actually is named after him but never uses his name.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So he comes to the United States not knowing what to expect, except that his brother showed signs of having these same tendencies even when he still lived in Dublin, when he hung out with drunks and derelicts.
Right.
I don't know if there's a question emerging from this. Tell us about Kieran. Maybe that's a good idea.
I wanted to talk, when I talked about Corrigan, I wanted to talk about faith. And, you know, at the time, we're talking about like serious ideas of liberation theology, and how do they fold over onto ideas that we have about faith today. And also, there are good people in the world. Like, this guy is involved in the Catholic Church. He's with the Petit Frère de Dieu. Like, he's a friend, like kind of like a French worker priest, but he's, as you say, he's not ordained in the priesthood. And he's a monk. And really what he thinks is, my influence can enter the air. And it's hard to write sometimes about good people. It's hard to write about like people who do, you know, have acts of faith. And one of the things that strikes me, I don't know if you'd agree with this, but, you know, for evil to occur, like, say, the towers coming down, which is, you know, part of what this book is about, it only has to happen once, right? And then it exists in the world. For goodness to occur, or for happiness to occur or reoccur, it has to keep on going. We can't, there is no X spot for goodness. There's no place where it says, yeah, it finishes here. There, I was like, that was a good act, and therefore good exists forever. Mm-hmm. But evil, as we know, throughout like the 20th century, even the first part of this century, it was the most and least humane of centuries, the last century. For evil to occur just had to happen, you know, that one time. And that's one of the concerns of the book, that Corrigan, this Irishman who goes over to work with the hookers in New York, he just wants to sit there and let his influence enter the air, which is a sort of rare thing. And so I wanted to write about a priest or a Catholic who wasn't involved in pedophilia, and like a good fella, mm-hmm. you know? And then his crisis is that he falls in love. And, you know, what a crisis to have.
Yeah, we don't know exactly what to root for. I knew what to root for, but... Shakespeare said, the evil that men do lives after them, the good is often turned with their bones. I suppose that's true of cultures as well.
Well, that is true of cultures. And that's an interesting way of putting it, which forces us into the realization that, you know, we become the sons of our son, that we must go on. And you know, if that goodness gets buried with us, then it has to be passed on to generations. I don't get sentimental or corny about it, but, you know, there is the opportunity and the necessity for grace. Mm-hmm. And we can talk very easily about all the evil that goes on in the world. We can talk about Darfur, we can talk about Northern Ireland, we can talk about, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq, whatever it happens to be. It's harder to sit and talk and praise beauty, you know. It's a, you know, but why not do it, you know?
Yeah. I agree. I encourage that. This book is not sentimental. You have characters who are sentimental. Right. Claire is a sentimental character.
That's right.
Almost to a fault. But you're writing about Claire as almost reportorial. You allow her to be without commenting on what she is. You allow us to make our own judgments about that. Right. I find that very, very admirable. Let's talk about Claire and Gloria for a while. Claire and Gloria meet unlikely because Gloria lives in the Bronx, right near where Corey is.
That's right.
And Claire lives on Park Avenue. And she's the wife of a judge. Right. And she's living a luxurious life, except... Mm. The thing that unites them is they both lost sons in Vietnam. In fact, Gloria's lost three sons.
Right.
And they're in a support group, I suppose, for want of a better term, of women from various parts of the city, including one from Staten Island. And they get together to support one another, but there's a bond that happens between Claire and Gloria. Tell us about that.
Well, first of all, I have to say you've done the most extraordinary like reading of the book, and I really appreciate that, because that means a lot. This intricacy that we're talking about between a poor working class woman, an African American woman, and in the Bronx, and then a rich mother on Park Avenue. It was a hard thing to go for and to try to achieve, and they brought together by the common bonds of war. You know, I've spent most of my life writing about like things that are on the edge, like did homeless people in the subway tunnels in New York for a book called This Side of Brightness. For Zoli, I was with the gypsies in Slovakia, and I've never really gotten to the heart of you know, what it means to be sort of wealthy living on Park Avenue. My own little terrible secret is that I have no street credibility whatsoever, and I live on the Upper East Side of New York myself. And I wanted
Don't apologize.
I do apologize, though. I end up apologizing all the time. I'm desperate. But I wanted to...
You know, you take your Irish Catholic soul with you wherever you go, don't
exactly
you?
That's exactly right. It's all that Catholic guilt. But I wanted to understand, what's it like to be a mother, a woman on Park Avenue, and she's terrified because all these women, working class women, are coming to their house to share in a sort of grief group about Vietnam, and she's terrified because she thinks that they'll think that she's posh. And she's lording it over them because she has a Miro on the wall. The chapter title is called Miro, Miro on the Wall. She ended up being one of my favorite characters, this sort of upper class Park Avenue woman, because she became whole for me. And then she rescues the novel. I can't give it away, but really, in a certain way, she rescues the whole novel for me. And I was surprised by her. You know, you create these characters and then you're not sure what they're going to do to you. But she knocked the living daylights out of me when I discovered towards the end of the novel what she was about to do. Because most of the time as a writer, you don't even know what your characters are going to do.
Well, assuming that each character that you create is some piece of you, or comes from some facet of your psychology or your personality, when did you start to feel a connection with Claire? Because she could have been just a cipher in the book, really.
She could have been. I don't know. It's, but when she began talking about how she missed her son, she says at one stage that she's talking to her son. He's about to go off to Vietnam. He's becoming a computer operator. And all she wants to say to him is, the only thing you need to know about war, son, is don't go. Right? But she doesn't say it to him. And she misses the fact that she didn't say it to him. And I think the commonality of experience, like, you know, we all experience grief in certain ways. And, you know, one set of grief is not more valuable because it's working class, you know, or it's not more valuable because it's upper class either, you know. It's, I hate that word, upper class. Such a silly word to use.
It's a common frame of reference. You might as well just go with it.
Yeah, but I should stop. I should not use it, not to censor myself. But, you know, I just want to say that these people are in the muck and the grime together. And that's important for us, I think, to realize. So when she came about and when she presented herself to me and she sort of gave me a voice, I was very happy. But I was happiest of all when I was happiest of all when I met the 38-year-old hooker.
Mm-hmm. Tilly.
Yeah.
Tilly's wonderful. Tilly's wonderful in many ways because she's... she herself is a really good person who's come upon bad straits and has had to sell herself.
Right.
And she has a child when she's very, very young. And her child has children when she's very, very young.
Right.
But the two of them are on the stroll, as the phrase goes.
Right.
And Tilly and Jaslyn, her daughter, right. Tilly looks out for her. Tilly mothers her even when the two of them are performing an unsavory task.
Sure, sure. I mean, she says at one stage, it's no less love if you're a hooker. It's no less love at all. Actually, a friend of mine has just written a song called The House That Horse Built, horse being the word for heroin,
yeah.
Based on the Tilly chapter. And he sings the song. He says, it's no less love if you're a hooker. It's no less love at all. Hey, God, when you figure out why you took her, why you let me do this to her, he says, you better crawl back down, you better hit the ground, you better come uptown in your holy white gown and give sweet Tilly a call. You know, I don't know, there was something about finding her voice. I worked and worked for 6 months trying just to get one phrase going. When she finally sort of again presented herself to me and I found her voice, I was amazed by these things that she was saying. And as you say, maybe it's just all little parts of your own subconsciousness mm-hmm. coming to the fore.
What else you got? I mean, all you can write about is what you know and what you feel.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I tell my students that, you know, you should write about what you don't know about, or you should write about towards what you want to know. Because in the arc of going towards what you want to know, you will discover what you knew but weren't entirely aware of. Because you're absolutely 100% right. Because it is physically, morally, socially, philosophically impossible to write what you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but if you write towards what you want to know, you'll discover new things. That's the best lesson, I think, for you know, aspiring writers.
Yeah, well, you writers do three things. They write about what they know, they write about what they can find out, mm-hmm. and they write about what they make up. That's right. And the makeup part is sometimes that's where you're out on thin ice, because if you don't challenge yourself when you're writing, you might as well just do magazine articles for your local throwaway shopping center guide.
Well, there you go. I mean, Sam Beckett said it best as far as I'm concerned. He says, no matter, try again, fail better. Because every book is a failure, and you have to want it to be a failure. You know,
the poet laureate of desperation, Samuel Beckett.
He would say things at the end of his life. He says, you know, I wouldn't swap it now, not for all the vivifying, you know, because he felt vivified by the idea that he wasn't getting it entirely right, and he wanted to go on, and he had this fire in him, at the end of his life. He said, I adore that idea. You know, don't. What is it that Dylan Thomas? You know, fade against the dying.
Going out gentle in that diet, and that, yeah.
That
but rage against the dying of the light.
Rage against the dying of the light. Yeah.
Everybody should see Waiting for Godot once in their life, but you should also read it, because one of my favorite things in Waiting for Godot is the either Estragon or Vladimir says, I can't stand it here anymore. We must go. And the stage direction is they do not move.
So I heard a great story about Beckett was talking to one of the cleaners at one of the theaters where it was going on, and you know, everybody was debating whether or not, you know, Godot was going to come along, and the cleaner said, "Sure, Mr. Beckett, I knew that Godot wasn't going to come into the play at all. I knew from the very get go." And he said, "Well, how do you know that?" He said, "Well, Mr. Beckett, he wasn't in the bleeding program."
That's brilliant. So, listen, what are you working on now?
Oh, you know, I honestly, Ed, I put an awful lot into this book, and I was pretty emotionally wiped for, you know, afterwards. It's come out very quickly, and I'm looking, I'm sort of waiting for this book to see how it settles, and. Because sometimes you got to look at it and think, right, how do I go? I'm almost sure I'm going to go in and do a collection of Irish short stories, and like something quiet, because this is a big, loud book.
Modern Ireland. The tiger of the
North Sea.
Anymore.
And how the tiger fell, you know, and how the tiger got old and faded away, and the teeth got round.
You know, it's so fun. I mean, this so. Is part of the Irish culture and Irish feeling, the fact that we will have it good for a while, but it will all be taken away from us.
Yeah, I mean, there's always that feeling. But we got so bad for a while. We just, like, everybody was talking about traffic and mortgages, and you go around, you know, and that was it. Like, fellas walking into pubs with holsters, with four mobile phones. It was like the Wild West of telecommunications.
Yeah. That's awful, isn't it? I think that fatalistic quality is why Jews and Irish get along as well as they do.
Right.
Both drunk with words, and both have a fatalistic view of the universe. So.
Absolutely.
Well, before I get too sentimental myself here, this has been a wonderful interview. Thanks very much. And when that short story book comes out, I hope you'll come back.
I'll come back. And thank you for reading so closely. I mean, it is quite extraordinary. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. That's very kind of you to say. The title of the book is Let the Great World Spin, Colin McCann. Random House published it. Thanks so much.
Thank you.